26. It was impossible to listen to such stories empty-handed. As soon as Grayson started one, Maniac would reach into one of the equipment bags and pull out a ball or a bat or a catcher's mitt. Sniffing the scuffed horsehide aroma of the ball, rippling the fingertips over the red stitching, it's hard to say how these things can make the listening better, but they do, and for Maniac, they did. And of course, as happens with baseball, one thing led to another, and pretty soon, the two of them were tossing a ball back and forth. And then they were outside, where the throws could be longer, where you could play pepper on the outfield grass of the Legion Field, the old man pitching, the kid tapping grounders, where you could shag fungos, the old man popping high flyers, the kid chasing them down. And now the stories were mixed with instruction. The grizzled, rickety coot, showing the kid how to spray liners to the opposite field, how to jump a long fly even before the batter hits it, how to throw the curveball. Stiff, crooked fingers that grappled clumsily with crimped wrappers curled naturally around the shape of a baseball. With a ball in his hand, the park handyman became a professor. As to the art of pitching, of course, the old man could show and tell, but he could no longer do, except for one pitch, the only one left in his repertoire from the old days. He called it the stop ball, and it nearly drove Maniac goofy. The old man claimed he discovered the stop ball one day down in the Texas League, and that he was long gone from baseball when he perfected it. Unlike most pitches, the stop ball involved no element of surprise. On the contrary, the old man would always announce it.
"Okay," he'd call from the mound. "Here she comes. Now keep your eye on her, 'cause she's gonna float on up there. And just about the time she's over the plate, she's gonna stop. Now, nobody else ever hit it, so don't go getting upset if you don't either. It's no shame to whiff on a stop ball."
And then he'd throw it. Well, of course, Maniac knew that most, if not all of that, was blarney, and just to make sure, he watched the ball extra carefully. There sure didn't seem to be anything unusual about it, not at first anyway, but as the ball came closer, it did somehow seem to get more and more peculiar. And by the time it reached the plate, it might just as well have stopped because Maniac never knew if he was swinging at the old man's pitch or at his speech. Whatever, in weeks of trying, he never hit it out of the infield. It was October. The trees rimming the outfield were flaunting their colors. The kid and the geezer baseballed their lunch times away and the after-dinner times and weekends. And every night, as the old man left for his room at the Y, he would grouse,
"You ought to go to school."
And one night the kid said back, "I do." And that's how the old man found out what the kid was doing with his mornings. He had noticed the books before. Rows and piles of them that kept growing, but there being books, he didn't think much of it. Now, the kid tells him, "You know the money you give me?" Each morning, he gave the kid 50 cents or a dollar to get himself some crimpets. "Well, I take it up to the library. Right inside the door, they have these books they're selling, cases of them, old books they don't want anymore. They only cost 5 or 10 cents apiece." He pointed to the piles. "I buy them." He showed them to the old man. Ancient, back-broken math books, flaking travel books, warped spellers, mangled mysteries, biographies, music books, astronomy books, cookbooks.
"What's the matter?" said the old man. "Can't you make up your mind what kind you want?"
The kid laughed. "I want them all." He threw his hands out. "I'm learning everything." He opened one of the books. "Look, geometry, triangles. Okay, isosceles triangles. These two legs,
they look equal to you?" The old man squinted. He nodded. "Okay, but can you prove it?" The old man studied the triangle for a full minute.
"If I had a ruler, maybe."
"No ruler." The old man sighed.
"Guess I give up."
So the kid proved it. Absolutely, dead center proved it. 2 days later, while playing Pepper in the Legion infield, the old man said to the kid,
"So why don't you go ahead and teach me how to read?"
27. The story he told now was not about baseball. It was about parents who were drunk a lot and always leaving him on his own, about being put in classes where they just cut paper and played games all day, about a teacher who whispered to the principal just outside the classroom door, "This bunch will never learn to read a stop sign." Right then and there, as if to make the teacher right, he stopped trying.
"The part I didn't tell about Bluefield, I was only 15. I ran away."
The kid and the old man climbed into the pickup. They made 3 stops. First, they stopped by the park office at the zoo, where Grayson told the superintendent he just wanted to work part-time for a while, in the afternoons. "Fine," said the superintendent, "just so you don't expect to get paid full-time." Then they went to the library book sale racks and bought about 20 old picture books, such as The Story of Babar and Mike Mulligan's Steam Shovel and The Little Engine That Could. Then they went to Woolworth's for a small portable blackboard and a piece of chalk. Within 3 days, Grayson had the alphabet down pat, the shapes, the sounds. After a week, he could read 10 one-syllable words, but he was reading them from memory. It took another couple of weeks before he began to get the hang of sounding out words he had never seen before. The old man showed an early knack for consonants. Sometimes he got M and N mixed up, but the only one that gave him trouble day in and day out was C. It reminded him of a bronc some cowboy dared him to ride in his Texas League days. He would saddle up that C, climb aboard and grip the pommel for dear life, and old C, more often than not, it would throw him. Whenever that happened, he'd just climb right back on and ride her some more. Pretty soon, C saw who was the boss and gave up the fight. But even at their orneriest, consonants were fun. Vowels were something else. He didn't like them, and they didn't like him. There were only 5 of them, but they seemed to be everywhere. Why, you could go through 20 words without bumping into some of the shyer consonants, but it seemed as if you couldn't tiptoe past a syllable without waking up a vowel. Consonants, you knew pretty much where they stood, but you could never trust a vowel. To the old pitcher, they were like his own best knuckleball come back to haunt him. In, out, up, down. Not even the pitcher, much, much less the batter, knew which way it would break. He kept swinging and missing. But the kid was a good manager and tough. He would never let him slink back to the showers, but kept sending him back up to the plate. The kid used different words, but in his ears, the old minor leaguer heard, "Keep your eye on it. Hold your swing. Watch it all the way in. Don't be anxious. Just make contact." And soon enough, that's what he was doing, nailing those vowels on the button, riding them from consonant to consonant, syllable to syllable, word to word. One day, the kid wrote on the blackboard, "I see the ball." And the old man studied it a while and said slowly, gingerly, "I see the ball." Maniac whooped, "You're reading.
I'm reading, yipped the old man. His smile was so wide, he'd have had to break it into sections to fit it through a doorway. 28. The first book Grayson read cover to cover was The Little Engine That Could. It took almost an hour and was the climax to a long evening of effort. At the end, the old man was sweating and exhausted. The kid's reaction surprised him. He didn't jump and yippee like he did after the first sentence. He just stayed in the far corner, seated on a stuffed and lumpy equipment bag. He had kept his distance all during the reading, letting Gracie know there would be no cheating. He had to do it on his own. Now he was just staring at Grayson, a small smile coming over his face. And now he was making a fist and clenching it toward Grayson, and he said, "Amen."
"What's that? Amen? What's that for? Who prayed?"
"I learned it in the church I used to go to. You don't have to wait for a prayer. You say it when somebody says something or does something you really like." He hopped off the bag, thrust both hands to the ceiling, and shouted, "Amen." And suddenly the kid was hugging him, squeezing him with a power you never suspected in that little body, unless you had seen him pull a baseball almost to the trees in dead center field. "Okay," said Maniac, clapping his hands. "What'll it be? I'll be the cook. Whatever you want." Maniac had a toaster oven now, compliments of his whiskered friend. In fact, little by little, Grayson had brought him a lot of things. A chest of drawers for his clothes, a space heater, a 2-foot refrigerator, hundreds of paper dishes and plastic utensils, blankets, a mat to sleep on, which the kid ignored, preferring the chest protectors. In time, the place was homier than his own room at the Y.
"How about a corn muffin?" said Grayson, choosing something easy on his bad teeth and aching gums.
Maniac went to the bookcase that served as a pantry. "One corn muffin coming up. Toasted?"
"Yeah, why not?"
"Butter?"
"Sure, butter."
"Something to drink with that, sir?"
"Nah, muffin's enough."
"The apple juice is excellent, sir. It was a great year for apples." "Live it up," thought Grayson.
"Yeah, okay. Apple juice."
"Coming right up, sir." After the snack, the kid proved himself as good a mind reader as a cook. "Why don't you stay overnight?" he said. "It's late." While he groused about so preposterous an idea, the kid laid down the mat he never used, bulldogged him down to it, pulled off his shoes, and draped a blanket over him. He protested.
"This is supposed to be yours."
The kid patted his chest protectors. "I'm okay. I'm okay." And he knew that was the truth of it. The old man gave himself up willingly to his exhaustion and drifted off like a lazy sky-high flyball. Something deep in his heart, unmeasured by his own consciousness, soared unburdened for the first time in 37 years. Since the time he had so disgraced himself before the Mud Hen Scout and named himself thereafter a failure. The blanket was there, but it was the boy's embrace that covered and warmed him. When somebody does something you really like. "Amen," the old man whispered into the cornmeal and baseball-scented darkness. 29. For most of November, winter toyed with Two Mills, whispered in its ear, tickled it under the chin. On Thanksgiving Thursday, winter kicked it in the stomach. But that didn't stop the old man and the boy from joining the 10,000 who thronged to the stadium on the boulevard to see the traditional high school football game. The Arctic air laid panes of ice over the crayfish edge pools of Stony Creek. The effect was the opposite on human noses. Maniacs and Graysons ran like faucets, and not a handkerchief in sight. They deputized their sleeves and grabbed handfuls of napkins from the refreshment stand. 2 Mills won the game, thanks to a last-minute 73-yard TD pass from quarterback Dennehy to James hands down. From the instant his old trash-talking Sandlock pal cradled the ball in his long brown fingers, Maniac was jumping on his seat, screaming trash at Hans's pursuers every step to the goal line and glancing about to make sure Mrs. Beale wasn't hearing. By the time they got back to the baseball room, they were nearly frozen. But the freeze was good, for it made the warmth of the little apartment all the more welcome. Within 15 minutes, the space heater had the place positively tropical, while in the toaster oven, their 5-pound Thanksgiving chicken was already beginning to brown. A pair of hot plates and a squad of pots were pressed into action, and by mid-afternoon, the two were sitting down to a feast of roast chicken, gravy, cranberry sauce, applesauce, SpaghettiOs, raisins, pumpkin pie, and butterscotch crimpets. Maniac thought of Thanksgiving's past, of sitting around a joyless table, his aunt and uncle as silent and lifeless as the mammoth bird they gnawed on. He said this grace, "Dear God, we want to take this opportunity to thank you for the best Thanksgiving dinner we ever had. Well, I ever had. I guess I shouldn't speak for my friend Grayson." He peeked across the table. "Grayson," he whispered, "is this your best one too?" The old man opened one eye. He shrugged.
"Don't know. Ain't tasted it yet."
Maniac glared, rolled his eyes upward, hissed, "Grayson?" The old man flinched.
Yeah.
He squinted one-eyed at the chicken.
"Yeah, I guess it is."
"The best?" Maniac prompted.
"The best."
Maniac went on. "And we want to thank you for this warm house and for our own little family here and for Grayson learning to read. He's already read 13 books, as I'm sure you already know. And one more thing. If you can find some way to let the Beale family know I'm wishing them a happy Thanksgiving, I'd really appreciate it. They're the ones on 728 Sycamore Street, in case there's any other Beales around. Amen."
"Amen," said Grayson.
They stuffed themselves silly, then collapsed and listened to polka music. Grayson had brought over a record player a week before, along with his entire music collection, 31 polka records. Grayson loved polkas. Of course, one cannot listen to polka music for long before getting up and dancing, which is what the two Thanksgivers did as soon as their bloated stomachs allowed. They danced and they laughed, record after record. Whether it was the polka that they danced is another question. It was nearly dark, both of them having recollapsed, when Maniac said, "Is there any paint around?"
"Guess so," said Grayson. "What for?"
"You'll see. Can you get some? And a brush?" The old man dragged himself up.
"What color?"
"How about black?" 5 minutes later, the old man was back.
"Got brown. That do?"
"Fine," said Maniac. He opened the can, stirred the paint, put on a jacket, grabbed the brush, and went outside. Grayson followed. He watched the kid paint on the outside of the door in careful strokes. 101. Maniac stepped back, admiring his work. 101, he proclaimed. 101 Banshell Boulevard. 30. If Thanksgiving was wonderful, Christmas was paradise. By now, Grayson had officially moved out of the Y and into 101 Banshell Boulevard. Thanks to his long acquaintanceship with the locker room attendant, he and Maniac were privileged to continue using the Y's shower facilities at their pleasure. For decoration outside, they nailed a wreath to the door. There was only one small window, but it had no sill to hold a candle, so some spray snow had to do. Inside was another story. Santa's elves themselves would have felt at home. Strings of popcorn swooped across the ceiling. Evergreen branches flared at random, dispersing their piney aroma. Wherever there were a few vacant square inches, something Christmassy appeared. A matchbox creche, a porcelain Santa, a partridge in a pear tree. One day, Grayson dragged a pair of tree limbs in and started sawing away. When he was finished, a wooden reindeer stood in the room big enough for Maniac to ride. Of course, the tree got the most attention of all. By the time the two of them finished trimming it, their tree-trimming instincts having languished for so many Christmases, hardly a pine needle could be seen under the tinsel and balls and whatnot. In fact, though they were delighted with their effort, the urge to trim was still full upon them. One room was simply too small to hold the spirit bursting. So they went outside and crossed the creek and tramped the woods until they came to a fine and proper evergreen, and there, their footsteps muffled by the carpet of pine needles, their every breath and whispered word arrayed in frosty white, they trimmed their second tree. This time, the ornaments were nature's brilliant red and yellow necklaces of bittersweet pungent pine cones, wine-red clusters of sumac berries, abandoned bird-bodied boats of milkweed, delicate thumb-sized goblets of Queen Anne's lace. 31. It was still dark when Maniac awoke on Christmas morning. Within an hour or two, the holiday would come bounding down the stairs and squealing round the tinseled trees of Two Mills. But for the moment, Christmas bided its time outside, a purer presence. Maniac shook Grayson awake, but stayed the old man's hand when he reached to turn on the light. They bundled themselves and ventured into the silent night. Maniac carried a paper bag. Snow had fallen several days before. In much of the town, it had been plowed, shoveled, and sloshed away, but in the park, along the creek, the woods, the playing fields, the playground, it still lay undisturbed, save for the tracks of rabbits and squirrels. Beyond the tall pines, stars glittered like snowflakes reluctant to fall. They visited their tree. They stood silently just to be near it, letting the magic of it drift over them. In the pine-patched moonlight, the Queen Anne's goblets looked for all the world like filigreed silver. They walked the creek woods all the way to the zoo, meandering wordlessly through the snowy enchantment. As if by design, they both stopped at the same spot above the half-submerged, rooty clump of a fallen tree. Somewhere under there, they knew, was the den of a family of muskrats. The old man laid a pine branch at the doorway. Maniac whispered, "Merry Christmas." They visited the animals at the zoo, at least the outdoor ones, wishing them a happy holiday. The ducks seemed particularly pleased to see them. By the time they came to the buffalo pen, dawn was showing through the trees. Before the old man finished saying, "Wanna boost?" Maniac was up and over the fence. If Mother Buffalo was glad to see the fence-hopping human again, she didn't show it. But Baby came trotting on over, and the two of them had a warm reunion. Before leaving, Maniac reached into the paper bag and brought out a present. "For you," he said. It was a scarf, or rather, three scarves tied together. He wrapped them around Baby's neck. "Next year, I'll get you stockings for your horns," he grinned, "if you have them by then." A final nuzzle, and he was back over the fence. They headed back home as the town awoke. Breakfast was eggnog and hot tea and cookies and carols and colored lights and love. As in all happy Christmas homes, the gifts were under the tree. Maniac gave Grayson a pair of gloves and a woolen cap and a book. The book did not appear to be as sturdy as the others lying around. The cover was blue construction paper, and the spine, instead of being bound, was stapled. The text was hand-lettered, and the pictures were stick figures. The title was The Man Who Struck Out Willie Mays. The author's name, which Grayson read aloud with some difficulty, was Jeffrey L. McGee. Maniac, in his turn, opened packages to find a pair of gloves, a box of butterscotch crimpets, and a spanking, snow-white, never-ever-used baseball. He was overjoyed. He rushed to the old man and hugged him. The old man put up with that for a second, then pulled away.
"Hold on," he said.
He went to one of the baseball equipment bags and reached in, tunneled down to the bottom, and came up with another package. This one was wrapped crudely in newspaper.
"Hide and listen," he said. "Didn't know if you the kind of kid sneaks looks."
Maniac tore it open and gaped helplessly when he saw what it was. To anyone else, it was a ratty old scrap of leather, barely recognizable as a baseball glove, fit for the garbage can. But Maniac knew at once. This was Grayson's, the one he had played with all those years in the minors. It was limp, flat, the pocket long since gone. Slowly, timidly, as though entering a shrine, the boy's fingers crept into it, flexed, curled the cracked leather, brought it back to shape, to life. He laid the new ball in the palm, pressed glove and ball together, and the glove remembered and gave way and made a pocket for the ball. The boy could not take his eyes off the glove. The old man could not take his eyes off the boy. The record player finished the Christmas polka and clicked off, and for a long time there was silence. 5 days later, the old man was dead. 32. Most mornings, Grayson would be the first one out of bed. He would turn on the space heater, visit the Banshell lavatory, then heat up some water, get breakfast ready, and finally wake the boy with a gentle shake of the shoulder. On December 30th, it was the silence that woke Maniac, and the cold. The space heater wasn't on, no steaming cup sat on the table. The old man was still under the covers. Maniac went over. "Grayson?" He shook the old man. "Grayson?" He took the old man's hand. It was cold. "Grayson." He didn't run to the superintendent's office. He didn't run to the nearest house. He knew. He held the cold, limp hand that had thrown the pitch that had struck out Willie Mays, that had betrayed the old man's stoic ways by giving him a squeeze. He began talking to the old man about places he had been on the road, about places the two of them might have gone to, about everything. Then he began to read aloud. He read aloud all the books the old man had learned to read, and he finished with the old man's favorite, Mike Mulligan's Steam Shovel. When he looked out the window, it was night. He dragged his chest protectors alongside the old man's mat and lay down. And only then, when he closed his eyes, did he cry. The funeral, such as it was, took place on the third day of the new year. Maniac had at last gone to tell someone, the zookeeper, and from then on he pretty much stayed out of the way. Grayson came to the cemetery in a wooden box. The pallbearers were unknown to Maniac. They were members of the town's trash collecting corps, and as they huffed and bent to lay the box over the hole, they smelled vaguely of pine and rotten fruit. Maniac was the only mourner. He had thought the park superintendent might show, or the attendant at the Y locker room, or maybe the lady who ran the park food stand in summer. None was there. Only Maniac and the man from the funeral home and the 6 pallbearers and the 2 men off to the side smoking cigarettes and leaning on a little hole-digging tractor that made Maniac think of something. He smiled inwardly. Hey, Grayson, look, Mike Mulligan's steam shovel had a baby. High above, a silver plane crossed the sky, silent as a spider. A voice startled Maniac. When's he coming? It was one of the pallbearers. The man from the funeral home pushed down the top of his black leather glove to expose his watch.
Should be here by now. Should have been here 5 minutes ago. Well, how long we gotta wait?
The funeral man shrugged. All but one of the pallbearers lit up cigarettes. Maniac wished he hadn't come. This event had nothing to do with the man who once lived in the body in the wooden box.
I'm freezing my kachungas off, a pallbearer announced.
Me too, said another.
Hey, you know, called one of the gravediggers, we ain't waiting all day to fill in that hole.
Everyone looked to the man in the long black coat. He looked again at his watch. Traffic, probably.
The minister, thought Maniac. That's who we're waiting for.
A pallbearer walked over to the funeral man.
We hauled the stiff here. Ain't that enough? They only give us an hour.
Another pallbearer chimed in.
Let's go get some donuts.
Hot coffee, baby.
Loud clanks. A gravedigger was striking the baby steam shovel with a spade. The funeral man sighed. He pulled out his own cigarette, lit it from the glowing tip of the pallbearer's.
Give it 2 more minutes, then we'll see.
Maniac waited for one of those minutes, searching the horizon for signs of a minister. Whatever was going to happen at the end of the next minute, he didn't want to see it. So he ran.
Hey, kid, they called. Yo, kid.
But he was running. Running. Part 3. 33. January of that year was too cold and dry for snow. It was a month of frozen hardness, of ice. Maniac drifted from hour to hour, day to day, alone with his memories, a stunned and solitary wanderer. He ate only to keep from starving, warmed his body only to keep it from freezing to death, ran only because there was no reason to stop. Even if the superintendent had allowed it, he could not have brought himself to stay at the Bandshell. He returned only long enough to pick up a few things, a blanket, some non-perishable food, the glove, and as many books as he could squeeze into the old black satchel that had hauled Grayson's belongings around the minor leagues. Before he left for good, he got some paint and angrily brushed over the 101 on the door. During the days, he ran, usually a slow jog, but sometimes he would suddenly sprint, furious 10 or 20 second bursts, as though trying to leave himself behind. Sometimes he walked. He crossed and recrossed the river. He wandered in all directions through all the surrounding communities and townships, Bridgeport, Conshohocken, East Norriton, West Norriton, Jeffersonville, Plymouth, and Worcester. Whenever he crossed the bridge over the Schuylkill, he turned his eyes so as not to see the nearby P&W trestle. Even so, in his mind's eye, he saw the red and yellow trolley careening from the high track, plunging to the water, killing his parents over and over. After a while, he stopped crossing the bridge. Other than that, he went wherever there was room to go forward, along roads and alleys and railroad tracks, across fields and cemeteries and golf courses. From high above, a tracing of his roots would have looked as hopelessly tangled as Cobble's knot. By nightfall, he was back in 2 Mills. He would retrieve the satchel from wherever he had stashed it and find a place to endure the night. A few times he revisited the buffalo pen, where he covered himself with the second blanket of straw. Other times his overnight quarters might be an abandoned car, an empty garage, a basement stairwell. When his original supply of food ran out, he fed himself at the zoo or at the soup kitchen down at the Salvation Army. He did odd jobs for housewives, ran errands for shopkeepers. He would not beg. One day he found himself among monuments and cannon and rolling hills. He was in Valley Forge. Here the Continental Army had suffered through a winter of their own, and the vast, stark frozen desolation itself seemed a more proper monument than statues and stones. The only buildings here were tiny log and mortar cabins, replicas of the Army's shelters. Maniac could feel the ache swelling outward from his breast and filling the enormous bounding spaces. He returned to town for the satchel and put himself up in one of the cabins. It was scarcely bigger than a large doghouse. The floor was dirt. There was a doorway, but no door. Several saltines fell from the blanket. He threw them outside, let the birds have them. He wrapped himself in the blanket and lay down. He lay there all night and all the next day. Dreams pursued memories, courted and danced and coupled with them, and they became one. And the gaunt, beseeching phantoms that called to him had the rag-wrapped feet of Washington's regulars and the faces of his mother and father and Aunt Dot and Uncle Dan and the Beals and Earl Grayson. And that bedeviled army, there would be no more recruits. No one else would orphan him. The second evening came and went. Maniac never stirred. Knowing it would not be fast or easy, and wanting, deserving nothing less, grimly, patiently, he waited for death. 34. It was during the second night in the cabin that he heard little voices. They were not soldiers' voices.
I'm going in this one. No, that one. That one's bigger. I'm tired. I'm stopping. You stupid meatball. It's right there. Another 2 seconds. I'm staying. Great, you beef jerky. Stay. I'm going to that one. Good night.
Silence. Then,
hold on. I'm coming.
That was all. The ghostly soldiers returned, their haunted eyes seeking warmth, food, life. There was no morning, only daylight in the doorway. He pushed himself up, dragged himself outside into the blinding light. The saltines lay in the brown frozen grass. The next cabin was nearby. January slipped his icy finger under his collar and down his back. He pulled the blanket tighter about himself, but it was too late. The finger had touched the last warm coal in his hearth, and his body, fanning the ember, shook itself violently. He walked to the next cabin, looked inside, and saw a body huddled in the corner. An eye opened, stared at him. Then in succession, three more eyes opened. The body divided and became two. Two little boys.
Get a load of this meatball, said the one with the front tooth missing. He walks around with a blanket on. Hey, meatball, why'd you bring your mattress along, too? And your pillow, too, screeched the other.
Then Missing Tooth whipped off his woolen cap and smacked Screecher in the face. Screecher retaliated, and Maniac had to step back while a two-kid tornado swirled around the cabin. When they were finished, they rolled onto their backs, shook their legs at the ceiling, and laughed as long as they had fought. The volume coming from Screecher was incredible, as though a microphone were embedded in his throat. Finally, Missing Tooth rediscovered the stranger standing in the doorway.
Hey, Meatball, you running away too?
No, not really, Maniac replied.
Well, we are, went Screecher.
Where are you going? Maniac asked. The answer came from both.
Mexico.
Maniac bit back a grin. When they stood, he saw they couldn't have been more than 4 feet tall or 8 years old. "Well," he said, "it's good and warm down there, but it's pretty far, you know."
"Yeah, we know," growled Missing Tooth. "You think we're meatballs like you?"
He grabbed a supermarket bag in the corner, opened it.
"Look."
It was filled with candy, cupcakes, pies, even a pack of butterscotch crimpets. Maniac's stomach rasped against itself. He remembered how thirsty he was. "Where'd you get all this?"
"We stole it,"
Screecher blurted. The other smacked him with his cap.
"Shut up, Piper, you stupid sausage. You don't go telling people you stole stuff."
Piper returned the cap slap.
"You shut up, Russell. I didn't tell him where we stole it."
This time the fight was over in less than a minute, but it started up again when Maniac asked where they were from, and Piper said,
"Two Mills,"
and Russell said,
"Shut up, he might be a cop,"
and bopped him good. When they settled down, they stared at him warily. Piper snickered.
"He ain't no cop, he's a kid." "Yeah," sneered Russell, "that's how much you know. They got cops that look like kids. That's how they catch kids."
They stared at him some more. They moved in cautiously, one on either side. They opened his blanket. They patted him all over.
"What are you doing this for?" Piper wanted to know. "We're feeling for a gun," Russell explained.
"Oh." After the patting, they backed off.
"So," said Russell, "you ain't a cop?"
"Not me," said Maniac. He moved in from the doorway. "I'm..." And with only a moment's pause, the story came to him. "A pizza delivery boy. We have a contest every week, and you two were chosen for a free pizza." The two gaped at each other.
"We were?"
"Yep, a large."
"Where is it?"
demanded Russell, glancing around. "At Cobble's Corner. You have 24 hours to claim your prize." He waited while they bickered over what to do. Valley Forge was a good 5 or 6 miles from Two Mills. These kids might not have made it to Mexico, but they had come a long way and stayed overnight, and someone somewhere must be worried sick about them, and he had a feeling they weren't kidding about stealing the food. He figured he better help them make up their minds. "You know," he said, "you're taking the long way to Mexico. If you come back to Two Mills with me, I'll show you a shortcut." That did it. Soon the two of them were trekking past the Washington Memorial Chapel, Russell and Piper with their bag, Maniac with his satchel. It was early afternoon when they walked into Cobble's Corner at Hector and Birch. Maniac produced his certificate for conquering Cobble's Knot, and 20 minutes later, the young runaways were attacking a large pizza with pepperoni. Maniac confined himself to 3 glasses of water and 6 crimpets. The boys agreed with Maniac that they ought to stay the night in their own house before setting out for Mexico in the morning. They were barely a block from Cobble's when Maniac heard a familiar voice. Bellowing and barreling down the street was the fearsome fastballer, King of the Cobras, Big John McNabb himself, and he was roaring mad. Maniac might have taken off, but he found himself clung to and clutched by the two little urchins. They huddled behind him like babies on a possum's back as Giant John came red-faced and huffing up to them. "Where you been?" he yelled. As Maniac considered what to say, the urchins peeped from behind.
"We wasn't no place, John. We was right here with this here kid. And he ain't no cop either. We checked him out."
For the first time, Giant John looked straight at Maniac. A smile crossed his face.
"Well, well, the frog man." The smile vanished. "So what are you doing with my little brothers?"
35. It took a while for everything to get straightened out. First, Giant John had to be convinced that Maniac was not kidnapping his brothers. Then the brothers had to do some more trembling and clinging while John finished lambasting them for running away, which apparently they did about every other week. Then when the brothers found out that their pizza person was none other than the famous Maniac McGee, the very same one who had blasted their big brother's fastballs to smithereens and finished him off with a home run frog, well, it took a good 5 minutes of rolling on the sidewalk to get all the laughing out of their systems, which of course got Giant John more than a little steamed. Prompting Maniac, who didn't like seeing John disgraced before his little brothers, to say, "Yeah, but didn't John tell you what happened the next day?" And the brothers said, "No, what?" And Giant John said, "Huh?" And Maniac winked at John and crossed his fingers. "Sure, John, you remember, wink, wink. At the Little League field the next day, you said I was lucky that all you threw me was fastballs because you weren't ready to reveal your secret pitch, the one you'd been working on. Remember? Wink." McNabb nodded dumbly. "And I said, well, come on, I can hit anything. Pitch it to me. And you pitched it. And I missed it by a mile. And you kept pitching it to me all day long, and I never even hit a foul ball on it."
"What was the pitch? What was the pitch?" chanted the urchins.
"It was..." Maniac paused for dramatic buildup. "The stop ball."
"The stop ball?"
"Yeah, and you should have seen it. It comes right up to the plate, looking all fat and easy to belt, and then just when you take your swing..." Maniac got into his batter stance and demonstrated. "It sort of stops. And your bat just whiffs the air." He whiffed an imaginary stop ball.
"Wow," said the brothers, gazing up at their big brother.
And so Maniac was invited to accompany the brothers McNabb to their home. Despite the cold, the front door was wide open, and Maniac could smell the inside before he could see it. The first thing he did see was a yellow short-haired mongrel looking innocently up at him while taking a leak in the middle of the living room floor.
"Clean that up," John ordered Russell. "Clean that up," Russell ordered Piper.
Piper just walked on by. After closing the front door, which was surprisingly heavy, Maniac found a stack of newspapers in a corner. He laid some over the puddle to soak in, then gave himself a tour of the downstairs. Maniac had seen some amazing things in his lifetime, but nothing as amazing as that house. From the smell of it, he knew this wasn't the first time an animal had relieved itself on the rugless floor. In fact, in another corner, he spotted a form of relief that could not be soaked up by newspapers. Cans and bottles lay all over, along with crusts, peelings, cores, scraps, rinds, wrappers, everything you would normally find in a garbage can. And everywhere there were raisins. As he walked through the dining room, something, an old tennis ball, hit him on top of the head and bounced away. He looked up into the laughing faces of Russell and Piper. The hole in the ceiling was so big, they both could have jumped through it at once. He ran a hand along one wall. The peeling paint came off like cornflakes. Nothing could be worse than the living and dining rooms, yet the kitchen was. A jar of peanut butter had crashed to the floor. Someone had gotten a running start, jumped into it, and skied a brown, one-footed track to the stove. On the table were what appeared to be remains of an autopsy performed upon a large bird, possibly a crow. The refrigerator contained two food groups, mustard and beer. The raisins here were even more abundant. He spotted several of them moving. They weren't raisins. They were roaches. The front door opened, and seconds later, a man clomped into the kitchen. He wore no winter jacket, only a sleeveless green sweatshirt, which ballooned over his enormous stomach. Tattoos blued his upper arms. His hands were nearly pure black. Stale body odor mingled with that of fries and burgers coming from the Burger King bag he held. Dropping the bag next to the bird remains, he bellowed, "Chow!" and took a beer from the fridge. He downed a good half of it in one swig, belched, double-clutched, and belched again. He had to know someone besides himself was standing in the kitchen, and just as obviously, he didn't care. Two floor-quaking crashes came from the dining room.
Geronimo! Geronimo!
Russell and Piper had taken the direct route via the hole.
What'd he bring, Dad? Whoppers? Yeah, whoppers.
They tore into the bag like jackals into a carrion. Plastic flew, fries flew. They both wanted the same whopper. Mashed between their tugging fists, the whopper splurted sauce and cheese and pickle chips, then it split. Russell lurched backward into the kitchen table with his half. Piper lurched backward in the opposite direction and, with nothing to stop him, sailed right through the cellar doorway and down the cellar steps. The final thud was followed by the truck horn blast of Piper's laughter. When Giant John ambled in, the father said,
"Get the blocks."
"No,"
grunted John, pulling out a pair of whoppers. He tossed one to Maniac.
"We need more," growled the father.
John didn't answer.
"We need more."
"I heard."
McNabb smashed the tabletop. Three fries and a bird wing jumped to the floor.
"Now!"
John walked out, nonchalantly munching.
"I was busy."
The rest of the night was scenes from a loony movie. Scene. McNabb the father swaggers bare-armed out the front door, bellowing back,
"Do your homework!"
Scene. Maniac retrieves the wet newspaper from the living room. There are no wastebaskets in the house. He finds a trash can in the backyard next to a pile of cinder blocks. He dumps the soggy papers in the can, which is empty. Scene. Small turds of an unfamiliar shape appear here and there along the baseboards of the first floor. "Please don't be rats," Maniac prays. Scene. The cobras come in. They glare at Maniac, but Giant John tells them to lay off. They raid the fridge for beer. They smoke cigarettes. They belch and fart. They curse. Russell and Piper, kitty cobras, pop their own beer cans, guzzle, swagger, belch, smoke, curse. Scene. Football game. From the front of the living room to the back of the dining room. Except for space, it has everything a regular game has: running, passing, blocking, tackling, kicking. There is little furniture to get in the way. Ordinarily, the windows wouldn't last 5 minutes, but the windows of this house are boarded up with plywood. Body-blocked cobras fly into walls. The house flinches. Scene. A faint, rustling noise behind the stove. Oh, no. Rats. Maniac dares to look. It's a turtle, box turtle munching on old whopper lettuce. Whew. Scene. The boys' bedroom. Russell and Piper lie prone at the hole. They fire toy submachine guns. Tadadat, 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 at the cobras heading out the front door. Piper jumps up and blows Maniac away, killing him at least 15 times.
"This is how we're gonna do it. Bam, bam, bam. The guns'll be real," says Russell, still prone and firing, the stock of the toy gun tight against his cheek. "Yes," squawks Piper. "Real."
He flops back to the floor, sprays the whole downstairs.
"Soon as they start coming in, bam, bam, bam."
"Who?" says Maniac.
"The enemy," says Russell.
"Who's that?" says Maniac. Russell stops firing long enough to send Maniac a where-have-you-been look.
"Who do you think?"
he sneers. He points the red barrel of the submachine gun toward the bedroom door, toward the east end, the heavy front door. Scene. Darkness. Silence. Sometime early morning, Maniac lies between the two brothers on the bed. Do cockroaches climb bedposts? Unable to sleep, asking himself, what am I doing here? Remembering Hester and Lester on his lap, Grayson's hug, corn muffin in the toaster oven, thinking, who's the orphan here anyway? Hearing as he at last lowers himself into sleep's deep waters, a door slam, a slurred voice,
do your homework!
Fearing, will I float? 36. The deal was, if Russell and Piper went to school for the rest of the week, Maniac would show them the shortcut to Mexico on Saturday. He figured if they all managed to survive till then, he'd come up with something. On Saturday, the boys had their paper bag packed, and Maniac had a new deal. Go to school for another week, and he'd treat them to another large pizza. Besides, he said, crossing his fingers, this was volcano season down in Mexico. The whole place was a sheet of red-hot lava. Better wait till it cools down. They bought it, and they bought the same deal the following week. But school was still agony for the boys. It had to be worth more than a pizza a week, but what? The brothers thought and thought about it and soon began to realize that the answer was sleeping between them every night. Ever since the famous Maniac McGee had showed up at their house, Russell and Piper McNabb had become famous in their own right. Other kids were always crowding around, pelting them with questions. What's he like? What's he say? What's he do? Did he really sit on Finsterwall's front steps? Is he really that fast? Kids started giving them knots, sneaker laces, yo-yo strings, toys, and saying, ask Maniac to undo this, will ya? Really little kids referred to him as Mr. Maniac. The McNabs ate it up in the streets, the playgrounds, school. The attention, not the pizza, was the real reason they put up with school each day. They began to feel something they had never felt before. They began to feel important. What a wonderful thing, this importance. Waiting for them the moment they awoke in the morning, pumping them up like basketballs, giving them bounce, and they hadn't even had to steal it. They loved it. The more they had, the more they wanted. And so when Maniac tried to cut the next pizza for school deal, Russell answered, no. No, echoed Maniac, who had been afraid it would come to this.
No, said Russell. We want something else.
Oh, said Maniac. What's that? They told him. If he wanted another week's worth of school out of them, he would have to enter Finsterwall's backyard
and stay there for 10 minutes,
screeched Piper, who shuddered at the very thought. When Maniac casually answered, okay, it's a deal, Piper ran shrieking from the house. On the next Saturday morning, Russell, Piper, and Maniac set out for Finsterwall's house about 7 blocks away. They took the alleys. Along the way, they were joined by other kids who were waiting, their eyes at once fearful and excited. By the time they got to Finsterwall's backyard, at least 15 kids huddled against the garage door on the far side of the alley. Maniac didn't hesitate. He walked straight up to the back gate, opened it, and went in. Not only that, he went all the way to the center of the yard, turned, folded his arms, smiled, and called, "Who's keeping time?" Russell, his throat too dry to speak, raised his hand. For 10 minutes, 15 kids and possibly the universe held their breath. The only sounds were inside their heads, the moaning and wailing of the ghosts of all the poor slobs who had ever blundered onto Finsterwall's property. To the utter amazement of all, when Russell finally croaked, "Time!" Maniac McGee was still there, alive, smiling, apparently unharmed. Even more amazing, he didn't come out. Instead, he said, "Say, you guys, how about adding to the deal? If I do something else while I'm in here, will you make it the next 2 weeks at school?"
"What are you gonna do?" stammered Russell.
Maniac thought for a minute, then announced it brightly. "I'll knock on the front door." 5 kids Finsterwallied on the spot. Several others screamed, "No, don't!" Piper went into some sort of fit and began kicking the garage door. Russell zoned out. Maniac took all of this to signify a deal. He hopped the backyard fence and strolled around front. The others went back down the alley and around the long way. They stationed themselves not only across the street, but almost halfway up the block. And even then, they squeezed together in a bunch, as though if they allowed any space between them, Fensterwall might somehow pick them off one by one. They huddled, trembling to bear witness to the last seconds of Maniac McGee's life. They saw him stand directly in front of the red brick, three-story house, the bile green window shades. They saw him climb the three cement steps to the white door, the portal of death. They saw him raise his hand, and though they were too far away to hear, they saw him knock upon the door, and 15 heartbeats beat in time to that silent knocking. The door opened. Fensterwald's door opened. Not much, but enough so the witnesses could make out a thin strip of blackness. Would Maniac be sucked into that black hole like so much lint into a vacuum cleaner? Would Fensterwald's long, bony hand dart out, quick as a lizard's tongue, and snatch poor Maniac? Maniac appeared to be speaking to the dark crack. Was he pleading for his life? Would his last words be skewered like a marshmallow by Fensterwald's dagger-tipped cane? Apparently not. The door closed. Maniac bounded down the steps and came jogging toward them, grinning. Three kids bolted, sure he was a ghost. The others stayed. They invented excuses to touch him, to see if he was still himself, still warm. But they weren't positively certain until later, when they watched him devour a pack of butterscotch crimpets. 37. Thus began a series of heroic feats by Maniac McGee. At 20 paces, he hit a telephone pole with a stone 61 times in a row. When the once-a-week freight train hit Elm Street, he started running from the Oriole Street dead end on one rail and beat the train to the park, no sweat. He took off his sneaks and socks and walked, nonchalant as you please, through the rat-infested dump at the foot of Rako Hill. The mysterious hole down by the creek, the one you would never reach into, even if you dropped your most valuable possession into it? He stuck his hand in, his arm in, all the way to the elbow, kept it there for the longest 60 seconds on record, and pulled it out, dirty, but still full of fingers. He climbed the fence at the American bison pen at the zoo. He had suggested this feat himself, everyone else scoffing. And while the mother looked on, kissed the baby buffalo. Nobody knows why buffalo became bull in the jump rope song. History often gets things wrong. So it went, through February and March of that year, a feat a week. To much of the town, hearing about these things, it was simply a case of the legend adding to itself, doing what legends do. To Russell and Piper McNabb, it was a case of boosting their importance ever higher in the eyes of the other kids. Was it not at the brothers' direction that Maniac McGee performed these deeds? And who, after all, is the more amazing, the lion or the tamer? As for Maniac, he understood early on that he was being used for the greater glory of Piper and Russell. He also understood that without him, they would not be going to school every day. For the McNabs, there was nothing free about public education. A tuition had to be paid. Every week, Maniac paid it. And besides, he loved to meet the challenges they cooked up for him. And then one day they gave him the most perilous challenge of all. They dared him to go into the East End.